As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
John Norman is the head of FX and commodities and international rates research at JPMorgan, joins us from our studios in London. John, great to speak with you once again. Let me start by asking you about the fallout from the effects of the election in France last week, and when you look at currencies, when you look at the FX space in Europe particularly, on the heels of that, what kind of a role has it played here over the last 5 days?
So I think the second round vote didn't have much of an impact on currencies because it was sort of a done deal after first round elections that Macron would be the president. So you did see a move up between first round and second round. It doesn't surprise me that second round didn't really deliver any follow through.
When you look at Washington and all that's happening there, very little happening on the Hill with regard to policy, very little happening with tax reform, very little happening with health care reform. And when you look at the legislative calendar, it's very compressed. There are, I think, 30-plus days left for Congress to do something. What effect is that going to have, do you think? What sort of likelihood are you pricing in there for some sort of tax reform package or health care reform package?
So I put very low likelihood on both of these. I just think they're complicated issues, and you have essentially a divided government, and that the Republican Party is not a cohesive block, and there's not a similar view on these policy issues between the White House and Congress. So our forecast hasn't changed at all as a function of the fiscal promises and some of these ambitions. But at the same time, you know, the bar is pretty low. If anything does happen on the fiscal side, it comes at a time when the economy is at full employment in our minds, and that just gives more of an upward bias towards rates and to the dollar.
Has your outlook for action in Washington changed at all with all of the distractions, with the latest news here about the FBI director? Have you changed anything when it comes to your forecast?
No, we haven't, because actually we started out quite skeptical that this administration would achieve much on the economic policy side, and that's a view we've had essentially since the election, because we just never really thought of Trump as a Republican, and we sort of acknowledged that the Republican Party itself isn't very cohesive between the various camps. So other people may be downgrading their expectations given all of the distractions that have emerged under this new administration, but we started out quite skeptical several months ago.
You have in your latest note here that May is living up to its reputation as a graveyard for high beta FX. Why is that the case? Why is May always a dog of a month?
People will tell you it's because clients don't like to hold positions into the summer. I don't think there's any empirical proof of that. The only empirical proof is that there's some tendency of markets to sell off, whether that's equities or high yield currencies in May, and that's kind of repeating itself.
Help me with the commodity space right now. I mentioned gold at the top. Let's move past gold to other commodities. A number of guests we've talked to over the last week have told us that the big motivator here is still what's going on in China. When you look at commodities in particular, what do you see as a driving force?
So there's two, and they affect sectors in different ways. So China and the credit tightening that economy is experiencing right now is the number one driver of the base metals, whereas expectations around this OPEC summit on May 25th is the number one driver of oil. So I think you can have divergence between those two sectors of a commodity index, depending on whether you think OPEC is going to tighten and how much longer you believe this credit crunch in China is going to persist.
Do you think that there'll be a continuation of that agreement? I wonder sort of what your outlook is for the future of OPEC. I remember a few months back we were debating the efficacy of or the importance of, continued importance of OPEC going forward. Has it reestablished that with this production freeze?
I think it's going to be rolled simply because the budgetary incentives that created consensus around an agreement last November are still in place, meaning countries just can't generate sufficient revenue if oil is below $50 a barrel. And that, to me, is the number one reason to think that this deal will be extended. It's right to be skeptical about the longevity of a deal because history suggests that these accords only restrain production for a year and a half, 2 years. But at the same time, we're still early in this process. The first accord was only 5 months ago. So I don't think it's now is the time to be skeptical. I'd be much more skeptical around the turn of the year.
John, I think my co-host has ambled into the studio there with you. Tom Keene, on the tail end of your trip to London.
Tail end. Finishing up. We'll see where
finishing strong.
Go for it. We'll be in New York on Monday. Really looking forward to that. David, we welcome all of you worldwide. Our studio's in London. I drove by, David, our new building. It is really getting occupancy or whatever the word
terrific,
is.
Yeah.
We're getting like close. It's just gorgeous. Over by Mansion House. Went by that in the surveillance limo last night. Bloomberg Surveillance Worldwide in London, in New York. With us, John Norman of J.P. Morgan. In the time that we've got left with you, John, I really want to talk about the spirit of this London. I was really struck yesterday by Governor Carney doing as he's supposed to do as a public official. Well, you know, we may see a slowdown. I see cranes still all over London. It's a different kind of, it's a construction project in New York City. I don't know if you've enjoyed crosstown traffic in New York City yes. recently. That's a sport. Is there still a boom going on in London?
There's a building boom in London. Unclear.
John, is this your first time on radio? Get closer to the mic. Come
on. Sorry, I'm here. Okay. Up against the mic.
Yeah.
So there's a building boom in place. Unclear that it's excessive relative to the demand because most of the analysis suggests that the UK needs to generate about 200,000 households a year or 200,000 new homes a year to keep up with demand. I don't know that when you look around London, you'd say that this is excessive.
What kind of sterling do we want? Or I guess I'd almost look at euro sterling and that I get there's a euro optimal for Germany. There's a euro optimal for France. What is a sterling optimal for the United Kingdom?
I think it would be a rate that's actually lower than it is now. Because the UK still runs, let's put it 10% lower, because the UK still runs a decent external deficit versus the rest of the world, and it's going through a very challenging growth period until there's some clarity around Brexit. So as the Brexit debate hangs over the economy, I think it justifies a weaker currency, actually.
You know, I was asking Tom yesterday the degree to which, as he walked around, he saw signs of this snap election, which is coming up on June the 8th. And I think, Tom, you said that you were surprised at how little it was being talked about or how few signs you saw. John Norman, is this playing a big role going forward? Is this kind of being seen as a done deal, a formality, or do you expect there to be do you expect this to take up more of the conversation here as we approach that date?
So I think because there were some expectations that a snap election would be called. It's not entirely a surprise. And also the main issue, which is being debated, whether or not May will have a stronger mandate, and this will allow her to negotiate more credibly with the Europeans. That issue is one that's going to play out over the course of several years. So it may be an important victory for her, but the macro results wouldn't be known for years. That's why I don't think this is a significant market issue.
One final question. It is quiet out there. How do you avoid losing money in FX when it's quiet? Do you just go away?
No, I think you need to avoid being highly exposed to carry, which is the same.
Explain that to our non-carry audience.
So the idea is that when volatility is very low, generally investors like to earn yield because they feel like there's very little that could
you get into the drug of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And since vol is mean reverting, this is just one of the few, you know, persistent patterns that we see in financial markets. It's only a question of time before vol goes higher and high yield currencies go down.
We'll play Carry On My Wayward Son as we go to the hour as well for John Norman. We need a little Kansas here in London. John Norman, thank you so much with Foreign Exchange with J.P. Morgan. We particularly appreciate Mr. Norman's attendance on the Gura Keen tour. He was in New York recently.
Yes, great to see him.
Good to see him. He could have said no David, but he didn't.
No.
He showed up here, which is a good thing.
It's
we like
coercive
that.
Power that
Very
you have,
Very powerful.
Yes.
With Roger Bootle. Mr. Bootle will be coming up as well. Should we be grandstanding and showboating today, David?
I was joking with YUN before the show. Yeah, some showboating going on in that interview with Lester Holt yesterday. President Trump saying that our former FBI director was doing too much of that. Some critics saying that's the pot calling the kettle black.
We'll look for some headlines off that. I believe Mr. Holt and NBC are giving it the Today Show treatment. Maybe
yes.
there will be something new here in the coming minutes.
David Gura in New York, Tom Keene in London. And Tom, I know that one of our favorite guests has joined you there in the studios in our London bureau.
Absolutely. This is a joy. Roger Bootle, and I want to spend some time here because people go, okay, Roger Bootle, we know he's going to say, et cetera, et cetera. He has one of the most twisted paths in United Kingdom economics with some real academic abilities out of Oxford, his work for years at HSBC. And a lot of people would have retired out and done whatever Roger Bootle does in his free time. He didn't. He went out and formed Capital Economics. They won the exceptionally prestigious Wolfson Prize, a huge deal when Capital Economics won that, and has moved on to advising various and sundry conservative governments. Mr. Bootle joins us now. Some of you may read his opinion, as it is in The Telegraph. How conservative is Prime Minister May? What of the 28 flavors of conservative is the Prime Minister?
Well, of course, we don't know. I think the signs are she's not very conservative. And interestingly, she's not pushing conservatism in her attempt to appeal to people across the spectrum, the voters across the spectrum, in Britain. You know, she's much more popular than her party. And the whole offer seems to be vote for me, I'm Theresa May, not vote for me, I'm a Conservative Prime Minister.
Well, vote for me, I'm Theresa May, and maybe the titles are done. And of course, we saw that within the French election as well. Separate out the Tory party right now, it's almost a year on from Brexit, isn't it? We come up on a one-year anniversary.
Yeah, well, the Conservative Party is split on a number of different issues. Of course, it has been split on Brexit because large numbers of Conservative MPs did not want the Brexit vote. Conservatives in the country were pretty much, not united, but overwhelmingly in favour of Brexit. I think the real chasm in the Conservative Party is between those people who would describe themselves as essentially Thatcherite, who want to continue with the legacy of Mrs. Thatcher, go further, indeed, on the one hand, and on the other, people who are more centrists. They call themselves One Nation Tories, following Disraeli in the 19th century, but you know, more communitarian, less competition, less keen on lower taxes.
The problem is, Roger, it's lost in translation, because the only thing David Gurr and I know about Disraeli is we love Disraeli Gears at Cream and Eric Clapton a few years ago. David Gura, jump in here, please.
Roger, let me ask you about post-partisanship. The fact that we've seen in France a winner who is from a new nascent political party. Here in the U.S., it seems like the role of party is being diminished as we look at the composition of the House of Representatives, all of the factions within the Republican Party. And from what you're saying about Theresa May and the conservatives there, are we moving beyond party sort of more globally than just here in the U.S.?
I think we probably are. And it's about time, too. I mean, lots of people are bemoaning all this and saying it shows some sort of crisis in democracy. I rather think it shows the opposite, actually. It's really pretty healthy that we're seeing people coming from outside the conventional party system and bending the rules, bending all the categories, appealing directly to the people. Now, of course, it may well be that there's going to be some pronounced disillusion either in the States or in France or Britain or whatever, with this new category of leader. I think that's quite possible. And then we'll have to see how the system reacts. But at the moment, I think this is really pretty good.
What role is the WTO going to play here in 2017, 2018? I spoke with the Secretary of Commerce here in the U.S., Wilbur Ross, and it sounds like he has some disdain for or disagreement with how it's run or how it has been run. He wants there to be more enforcement, et cetera. And I imagine you're dealing with the same issues there in the U.K. Is it going to take on a different shape, do you think?
Well, I hope so, because if Britain doesn't get a deal with the EU, and I think there's a fair chance that that will happen, then it will be relying on the WTO. And the WTO has been a pretty moribund organisation, sleepy, for quite some time. A lot of people in Britain in the know hope that Britain's going to reinvigorate it. Well, that may well happen, but actually Britain's going to be dependent on it. So it's pretty important.
Well, then, let's do this quickly and then come back, Roger, if we could. If Britain, quote-unquote, doesn't get a deal, does the price of Paul Roger champagne go up?
I don't know, and no one knows, because we don't know whether we're going to impose tariffs on Paul Roger champagne and indeed everything else. This is the, presumably we won't impose tariffs.
This is the only question I'm
particularly
asking.
We're
getting some intel on the duty-free shopping. That
by the way, it's something much better than that champagne, which is English sparkling wine. I could recommend. You should have it. It's much better. Wins all sorts of blind tasting competitions. The big question for Britain is going to be, should we impose tariffs or should we not? The EU will have its own decision, but for us this is a tricky one. And don't forget, under WTO rules, whatever decision we make, we've got to apply across the board to all countries.
Churchill just rolled over in Westminster when Roger Bowdler took shots at Paul Roger. That's what I know. Paul Roger, that was when Sir Winston's favorite champagne, to say the least. We will continue. It's your wine tour on Bloomberg Surveillance in New York and London with Roger Bowdler. Stay with us. This is Bloomberg. With us in our London studios, Roger Bowdler, who has a terrific and eclectic experience in economics and political analysis. David Gurr in New York. I'm Tom Keene in London. Roger, you studied at Oxford, and I believe John Hicks was the hero of so many at one time and place. Do the Hicksian models still work, or is our financial and fixed income mess and crisis and odd nominal and real yields so much so that ISLM doesn't work anymore?
Well, the Hicksian model is still taught, and I think that's pretty incredible. He supervised me, by the way, for a time, so I knew him. Incredible. Written in 1937, I think it's always had some pretty big gaps in it, quite frankly. I'm a Keynesian through and through, and I think especially at times of real crisis, you can't get away from the psychology that Keynes placed so much emphasis on. Now, of course, we are gradually getting away from the financial crisis now. We're moving back towards normal times. I think in that sort of environment, something like the Hicksian framework will again be relevant.
What are those normal times going to look like? Has our sense of normalcy changed?
We'll be older.
In light of all that we've been, we'll be older, exactly. Has our sense of normalcy changed as a result of that crisis?
Well, I think that's got to be true. I think we'll probably get back to something like 3% interest rates. Of course, that's a lot lower than was normal before. I doubt whether we'll get back to 4 or 5, which people used to think was normal. I suspect for a very long time. You could never be sure about these things, of course. You really can never be sure. I mean, the onset of this era of very, very low interest rates came as a massive surprise to people. And I think we've all got to be prepared for the unexpected. But I would be surprised if we get much above 3.
We love different guests and different views. And David, we've done that today. We had Professor Steve Keen of Kingston on yesterday, who tilts towards disequilibrium and a bit of a Marxist tinge to him as well. Roger, help us with a certitude that we get to equilibrium, or as Lord Desai of LSE or Steve Keen would say, I'm sorry, it is a world of disequilibrium. Can we have both?
Well, I think equilibrium is an important concept for economists to use when thinking about a framework, but the world's never in equilibrium, frankly, and most assuredly not now. It's a truism. People are always saying, oh, I've never known the world quite so uncertain. It's always been uncertain, actually. But I'm tempted to say it's more uncertain now. It's really interesting. You've got the emergence from the financial crisis and the beginnings of the move towards higher interest rates, coinciding, I think, with the onset of a new European crisis coming over the next year or two, and then, of course, the development of robotics and AI coming along on the supply side. The next 5 or 10 years are going to be disequilibrium on steroids.
Roger Bowdler, thank you so much.
Yes,
I look
great
forward
to
your next work in The Telegraph. Honored to have you here. Really, I tell you, David, it's just great to go from Steve Keen to John Norman of J.P. Morgan to Roger Bowdler. It mixes it up, to say the least.
Yeah, absolutely. What's your takeaway from this trip, Tom? You were asking Peter Elliott about curry last night. We don't have to talk about food. But
we're going to do it in five things you need to know, but the answer is London's London. I don't for a minute buy this, OMG, we're going to lose all these jobs to Europe. I just don't buy it. I could be wrong. I mean, we could talk another hour to Roger Bootle about it, but I'm sorry. It's amazing to be on the streets of Paris and the differential there from the streets of London. You can't talk about it. It's not video. You just got to feel it. There's a huge, the Anglo-American structure is sharply different than what we see in the theology of Europe. And it's been a real privilege. As I've said, folks, we're thanking people all through the week. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/lens.
Tom wrapping up a trip to France and to the UK. He was there for the elections on Sunday, headed back to New York after today's show. And Tom, a real treat here to have a guest by serendipity. This is Randall Krosner, the Norman Robbins Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago, who joins us this morning. Help us understand how you're viewing this debate within watchers of the Federal Reserve, participants in the Federal Reserve, about the balance sheet, how the Fed is going to be able to do this in tandem with raising rates.
It is the $4.5 trillion question, because that's roughly the size of the balance sheet. Will they be able to do this in a way that doesn't cause a disruption in the markets? I'm very heartened that they have already started to discuss this and put it into the minutes from the previous Fed meeting. And what's good is that starting the discussion has not caused a disruption. A few years ago, when Ben Bernanke started the discussion about the so-called taper, that they would slowly reduce the amount of asset purchases, that caused a lot of tumult in the markets. So far, this hasn't, and I think that's a positive step.
Give us your sense here of what the change in personnel on the Federal Reserve is going to mean for policy. And we've seen Randy Quarles' name floated as a potential vice chair. I don't think that's been made official as of yet, but we're beginning to see sort of a changeover in who's going to comprise this board of governors. How powerful a change is that going to be? Sort of what direction do you see the Fed heading in here, Randy?
Well, certainly, as you said, we don't have a lot of clarity about the potential changes in the board, because within the next year, the president potentially could replace the majority of the board, including the chair and the vice chair, who are, of course, very powerful figures in making monetary policy. So until we have greater clarity for that, it's hard to say whether there would be radical change or not. If he were to keep Janet Yellen on, and he has said positive things about Janet Yellen, then obviously I think there will be a lot of continuity, and you'll get the sort of process that we were describing before about the slow reduction of the balance sheet, a very gradual reduction of the balance sheet, and a gradual increase in interest rates. That could change with a different chair, but we really don't know that yet.
You know, we've had a lot of conversations about how the regulatory landscape in Washington may or may not change with this new president. How much of those changes could rest with the Federal Reserve? How much power does the Federal Reserve have to shape how the financial services industry is regulated?
The Fed certainly has a lot of power, not independent power, because there are other financial regulators that they work in concert with, but it can be a very powerful voice for regulatory reform and regulatory change. So there are certain things that are set by Congress and the Dodd-Frank Act, and so the Fed as well as the other regulators must follow those. But the actual implementation of that is largely up to the Fed and the other regulators. So there could certainly be a change. And my hunch is that if Randy Quarles were to be nominated and confirmed, that there would be some changes.
When it comes to how this Federal Reserve processes what may or may not happen in Washington, D.C., whether or not we get a big fiscal spending package, whether or not we get tax reform, how would you counsel they proceed? How difficult is it to forecast and plan with so many unknowns, so many variables when it comes to policy in Washington?
No, it's always very simple. No, certainly not. It's always challenging. So there's been a lot of emphasis on how uncertain the particular policy environment is, but it's always an uncertain policy environment. We never actually know whether there'll be shocks coming in, or there could be some changes. Now, there have been discussion of some fundamental changes, but those will probably have an impact over time rather than all immediate. And so I think the Fed wisely is looking into alternative scenarios, but sort of their kind of the main scenario that they're looking at is kind of the status quo for at least the short term, and then looking at possibilities for bigger changes in the intermediate to longer term.
Bobbins, professor of economics, former governor of the Federal Reserve System. Randy Croster joining us on the Spectrum Enterprise phone line from Italy this morning. Randy, thank you very much for the time.
Okay, this is a joy. We're going to massively rip up the script
right
now. Jeff Robinson is with us, who is expert on accounting and funny money. He works for a small startup bank, the Union Bank of Switzerland, UBS, here in London. And he's done some work with his colleague, Eric Sheridan, who's been better than good on Snapchat. There's been a wide range of failure over the debacle known as Snapchat. Mr. Sheridan has avoided the mindfalls, to say the least. When you look at a FANG stock, there's a lot of intangibles there. There's not bricks. There's not mortars. Okay. Do you trust the accounting as described on the balance sheet, whether it's the ginormous success of Alphabet or it's the struggles of a nascent Snapchat?
From a personal perspective, I guess I don't trust anything unless I understand it and I can dive into the numbers. So problem with accounting is a lot of the numbers need work on. So you might disclose non-GAAP metrics, GAAP metrics. You look at PP and intangibles on the balance sheet. At, you know, roughly 35% of the intangible value of a company will appear on the balance sheet. The rest of it is kind of in there in the ether. So I think if you take numbers that are reported on pure face value, at some stage, and I don't think it's that far down the timeline, you're going to get your fingers burnt.
Within that is the ether. I love that phrase. The ether that Silicon Valley plays by a different rule book. And I don't mean that to tar and feather. Bloomberg 960, good morning, out in California. Early morning, I should say, out in California. But is there a different rule book for these modern tech companies and their rights offerings and all the funny shareholder comp that they're doing?
From an accounting perspective, there's one rule book, and that's US GAAP. And, you know, US GAAP has evolved over the years to become more conceptually driven. But when you've got non-GAAP metrics out there where you can report what the accounts require to report, and then you can report your take on certain metrics, and those metrics don't have a huge amount of regulation around them, yeah, there is a separate playbook to run against. And you're looking at the tech companies, particularly with stock-based comp. You know, if you're excluding stock-based comp from your numbers, you're excluding, in my opinion, salaries. So, of course, your numbers are going to look great.
Let me just go back to legislation here. Go full circle. Tom's ripped up the script. Let me try to paste it back together here. There's been so much talk about a repatriation tax holiday. Yeah. How do you guarantee the best efficacy of that? If you implement one, how do you try to engineer it as such so that that money's going to be spent on CapEx, that's going to go to something worthwhile?
Yeah, that's a great question, because, you know, the fear is that we repatriate this cash and it gets dividended out, buybacks happen, and, you know, we're not creating U.S. jobs and it's not getting reinvested back into the business. And you can benchmark this against the effort in 2004, where retrospectively when they had that tax repatriation holiday, it didn't move the needle really on job creation and investment. So if it were me and I was running the country and I was looking at the legislation behind cash repatriation, there would be some mandated rules in there that would require a certain element of that cash to go back into the business. Because what's Apple going to do with $187 billion of cash it has overseas when it's generating?
Well, we'd like to get you in trouble this morning with the general counsel. What's Apple going to do? What are they going to buy? Come on, it's only Friday.
I don't know what they're going to buy, but they've got they have the ability to go out there and do fairly significant acquisitions. And I think from a valuation perspective, you know, the problem is with getting all that cash is that there's a risk that you do silly stuff.
Yeah.
And if you're not generating return in excess of the cost of that capital, you're destroying shareholder worth. So, you know, M&A, you know, this is something that's in our thought process. You know, the problem with M&A analysis is that it's very focused on EPS accretion and a stable credit rating. Your EPS goes up, your credit remains stable. You know, these deals get stamped as being good deals. Now, you've definitely got to look at the return behind those deals and how long it takes you actually to get a return that's in excess of that cost of capital. So the cash repatriation, I think, is a phenomenally interesting thing. I think it's one of the few things that there is agreement on in terms of getting this through the passage of Congress.
Jeff Robinson, great to get your perspective on this from London. Let me ask you quickly here in the limited time that we have left, how similar the situation is in the U.S. when it comes to corporate tax reform to what we heard talked about and indeed anticipate in France. Emmanuel Macron has said that he wants to implement new corporate tax reform. Do you think the process is going to play out similarly? How difficult do you think it's going to be there?
I think tax reform's difficult across the board. I mean, French tax, you know, there's a history that goes all the way back to Napoleon when you're trying to unwind those rules. With that level of detail, it's going to take time. It's complicated. There's a difference between tax reform and tax cuts.
Yes.
Tax cuts are relatively, you know, they're straightforward. They're politicized. They can be reversed. Tax reform, a simplification of the tax code, ultimately, you could argue, is you can have a lower tax rate with a simplified tax code that actually garners more revenue for the country.
Great to speak with you.
Wonderful. This has been great. Jeff Robinson. That's our watching paint dry segment for Friday. Double declining balance. You don't even do they still do double declining balance, Jeff?
Yeah, in the States they do. It's part of the tax code.
Double declining
balance. Double declining triple DB.
Yeah.
Oh, listen to you.
Yeah. I made that up right now, but very impressive.
Well, that's the Excel code you just found.
When you're in New York, be sure you don't talk to us. Jeff Robinson, thank you so much with UBS on accounting. Can't wait to do this again. Futures -4, Dow futures -24. This is Bloomberg from London, from New York. Wilbur Ross has been an awfully good friend of Bloomberg Surveillance. We have spoken to him many times. Of course, he is a financier. He is a tycoon, almost in a 19th sense. He has been hugely generous to his Yale University. And I must say, David Gura, Mr. Ross was way early in support of Mr. Trump.
He was, absolutely. Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, announcing last night a new agreement with China to promote market access for American natural gas, financial services, and beef, that the secretary said is part of a broader effort here to begin reshaping that trade relationship with the two world's largest economies. Let's go now to Wilbur Ross in conversation with our colleagues on Bloomberg Daybreak Americas.
I want to go into the substance of the deal, but before that, take me into the process, because I've been around some trade deals. They tend to take a long time, and this is really pretty fast. At the same time, you didn't have a special trade representative. Who did this deal? Did you do it personally?
Well, I did, and Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, we're the co-heads of the economic dialogue. But really, a lot of the work was done by Wendy Taramoto, my chief of staff.
So into the substance of the deal, we know that it covers a wide range of topics, as I say, from liquid natural gas to beef to financial services. At the same time, if you take these all together, how material are they in terms of the trade deficit with China right now?
Well, I think they're material in three regards. The first regard is, as you pointed out in your introduction, trade arrangements are normally denominated in multiple years. This one, this first set, has been denominated in tens of days. So there's a huge difference in how rapidly we got something done. Second, these are quite specific transactions with quite specific dates. Essentially, all of these things are scheduled to start on July 16th. In the world of trade, July 16th is a wink and a blink. And I think that's important for the third reason. We have a lot more issues to deal with the People's Republic of China. And I believe that the fact that we got these longstanding aggravations out of the way so quickly augurs well for the relationship pattern going forward. But we have many, many more issues, and so the next task will be figuring out a one-year plan, and then with some data points in between, some deliverables in between, and then once we get through the one-year plan with success, then let's work into a longer-term plan.
So give us a peek into that one-year plan. Should we expect a series of these sorts of deals coming out over the next year, or is it a different approach?
Well, we hope to have deliverables. I think one of the historic problems with trade is that it's become a kind of long-term debating society rather than something that was results-oriented. Both the Chinese government and we have become very results-oriented. And if we can keep that going, we'll get a lot done.
Well, as you suggest, sir, the things you addressed in this one are things that have been simmering for some time, and now you've resolved them, it appears. What's next on your list?
Well, as you know, it's, even when I was in the private sector, it wasn't my habit to speculate on what comes next. I'm much more comfortable announcing things as we actually accomplish them. And I think between now and the end of the year, we will hopefully have more announcements about actual accomplishments.
So to give you a sense, and I know you don't like to say what's going to come next, I have to ask you what comes next nonetheless. But give us some sense of the scope and the magnitude of what you hope to accomplish over that one-year period of time that you just said is your plan.
Well, there are all kinds of sectors that have not yet been addressed. So the methodology that we'll use is the same one we did here. The Chinese submitted their wish list. We submitted our wish list. We decided which of those items from the two lists were achievable within a very finite period of time. That's what we focused on. So now the question is, what time frame do we put on the issues that we didn't yet address? And so those talks will begin probably over the weekend.
So the skeptics, Secretary, are going to say, look, you got a $347 billion trade deficit with China. Exporting more beef and LNG isn't going to close the gap. So what's going to be on the agenda that will?
Well, it's a whole variety of things, but the gap is not just a gap. The gap is made up of hundreds and hundreds of different little items, and therefore there's not going to be one silver bullet that suddenly takes our trade deficit from the 300-odd billion to zero. That's not the way it's going
to
work.
Are you trying to get it to zero, Secretary?
No, we'll get it as far as we can. But the important thing is, as we accomplished here, we want to do it by increasing total trade and by increasing the ability of our companies to export. That's the number one objective, because that's what will create more jobs here. Number two is the trade deficit itself.
Yeah.
And that's the way we want to help solve that is with the beef. Beef, as you know, is a $2.5 billion market that we've been effectively precluded from. Your guess is as good as mine as to what market share we'll get. But symbolically, beef has been a big, big irritant for the agriculture community here, because that fussing around has been going on for way more than a decade.
Secretary Ross, the objective of your administration has been stated as quite clear, is to make trade fairer. The agreements with China, though, are meant to be win-win agreements. And I pick out a sector like the autos, and I wonder how you guys can come to a win-win arrangement when at the moment it's win-win for China and lose-lose for the United States. Give me an idea of how you can approach that situation that is a win-win for both countries.
Well, you can't take things in isolation, but the fact is that none of our trade deficit comes from China exporting automobiles to the U.S. There's an issue about the parts coming in and parts coming in from elsewhere through NAFTA and through other loopholes, but the Chinese do not actually sell cars here, So that's not the problem. Where our car deficit comes is much more with Europe, with Japan, and with South Korea.
We want to welcome once again our Bloomberg TV and radio audience. We are speaking with Secretary of Commerce Wilbur Ross. Now, Mr. Secretary, with respect to China specifically, does this indicate a different approach which essentially takes off the table the currency manipulation question?
Well, the currency manipulation question, for the moment at least, has been resolved. Currency manipulation is the function of the Treasury Department, not Commerce, and Congress has laid out very specific criteria as to what constitutes currency manipulation and what does not. The Chinese, by that definition, are not currency manipulators at this point in time, and that's why Secretary Mnuchin issued the order that he did. Now, that can change over time, but the more important thing is how do we bring jobs back? How do we make the gross domestic product grow faster? And how do we reduce the trade deficits? So there are myriad ways of trying to do that. A lot will be in goods, some will be in services. And we started on that here with the credit cards. The U.S. credit card companies had effectively been boxed out of China, all the electronic payment systems people had been. Now we've gotten that pretty well fixed. U.S. financial service firms had not been licensed to underwrite bonds or to clear bonds. Now that's getting fixed. So in addition to agriculture, in addition to natural gas, we also began in the services sector, but there's a lot more to do there, particularly the digital economy and a lot of other both financial and non-financial services. Services, as you know, have become a huge part of our economy and a huge part of our international commerce.
Mr. Secretary, you've now made a specific step forward with China. Does that free you up a bit to move on NAFTA, and particularly with respect to Mexico? Last time you and I spoke, we talked about when you would get moving with NAFTA. What does that timetable look like?
Well, I'm hoping it'll be quite imminent. As you might have noticed, the Senate yesterday finally confirmed my friend Bob Lighthizer as the United States trade representative. Some people in the Congress had been very reluctant to grant us the provisions of the 90-day letter until we had a Senate-confirmed U.S. trade rep. Well, he was confirmed last night. I believe he'll be sworn in on Monday, and I expect he and I will be making the rounds of Capitol Hill the early part of next week.
I did notice that confirmation. I was going to ask you about that because I know that you've worked with him before. I know that you're close. Is that going to pick up the pace as a practical matter? Because we know Mr. Lighthizer has a bit of experience in negotiating trade deals.
Well, Lighthizer is a wonderful addition to the U.S. trade rep position and to the overall effort to adhere to the president's agenda and fix our trade problems.
So finally, Mr. Secretary, I'm going to ask you something that may be a bit outside your jurisdiction, but you know about it and you care about it. And that is a report now that that your colleague, Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury, is urging regulators to take a look at the Volcker Rule and how they might amend that way that's being enforced. Is that essential to the deregulatory effort with respect to financial services?
Well, I think you ought to address Secretary Mnuchin on that topic. I think that there are some things about the Volcker Rule that probably should be changed, but I'm very busy with what is within my jurisdiction. I'm not going to go poaching on other people's.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.